This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. As much as three-quarters of the heroin on the world's streets comes from the fields of Afghanistan. During the Cold War, the U.S. armed Afghan drug traffickers to fight the Soviets. As part of the war on drugs, the U.S. provided aid to the Taliban. What will the war on terrorism mean for drugs and development in Afghanistan? First, it's the most anticipated video release of the year, the Osama bin Laden tape that allegedly ties him to the 9/11 terrorist attacks directly. The White House again today delayed releasing the tape. Walter Pincus is a reporter with The Washington Post. I asked him what the real story is behind the delay and where the so-called smoking gun tape is right now.
I guess physically it's probably technically in the possession of the White House, but I think the last I heard, the Pentagon was going to be in charge of reproduction and doing a sort of second double check of the translation.
Does that sound like a credible explanation to you as to why it's being delayed, or are they still working over the political and ramifications of putting it out?
I think they pretty much decided. I think there were a couple things going on this week when they sort of reached the conclusion they had to release it, and that is, how do you do it in the best possible form? The sound's not very good. It goes off in places, and they didn't want to be accused of sort of messing around with the words. Critics would start saying, well, now where does he say exactly that? The issue since then has been, should there in fact be a running open captioning so that as the words come out and the Arabic is heard, people who know Arabic can place what's said with what we translated it to, rather than just putting the tape out and then putting a transcript out and letting you figure what word
go with
is
what
translated
Arabic.
There. They're very much concerned about having the credibility of it questioned because they believe it's so good and so strong.
Take us back briefly to where the tape came from and what's the most incriminating piece of it. What's on it?
It was found in a private home in Jalalabad and came into the possession of our intelligence people.
It's a dinner party, or?
It looks like a celebratory dinner for an aging sheikh who was somehow wounded, with a group of men sitting around sort of cross-legged on the floor with food bowls in front of them. They come in and serve. It's an amateur cameraman. I mean, it's clearly not done professionally, and in fact, there are parts of the tape that run over other parts of it. It looks like he was at the end of the tape and then retaped as he went on over some stuff that he'd done before.
Does the camera seem to linger on Osama bin Laden, or is this just a kind of birthday party tape?
I think it's more of a, but I haven't seen it, so I have to confess I've been told about it now about a half dozen times, and different people have different reads on it. But everybody highlights a number of things. One is that in his discussion of September 11th, he makes a point, first of all, of saying not everybody knew. He points to his press aide and laughs about how his press aide came running in to tell him about it. And he had to say, you know, you didn't know, but I did know. He then recalls that when the first news came out before his press secretary showed up, he was with a group and he announced what had happened. The first tower had been hit and they all cheered. And then he puts his hand up, it's described to me by somebody who knows the Arab culture, and then says, but in effect, using his hands, just wait, there's more to come. And then at another point he discusses, again using his hands, that when the plane hit, they believed initially that it would just collapse from the top down to where the plane strikes, and then sort of praises Allah or God that in fact it went on and destroyed the whole building.
And that then is the smoking gun segments.
That, and well, then there's another one about he discusses at another point Muhammad Atta, describes him as a leader of the group, and then says that some of the participants were not told what the mission was, until they were actually boarding the plane, mm-hmm. which people have interpreted to say that some of them didn't know that they were doing more than just hijacking an airplane.
That it would be a suicide run.
A suicide mission for them. But that to me is not clear. I've tried to keep it in the terms in which it's described. He mm-hmm. describes it.
Walter Pincus, how do you imagine the conversation about the tape went within the administration about its release? Was there ever any question that it would be released?
Well, I think the initial debate, if you call it a debate, was there's great concern about trying to be more convincing, particularly in the Arab world. Mm-hmm. I'd just been out there 2 weeks ago, and in fact, one of the questions I gave a talk at the Dubai Press Club, and mm-hmm. repeated questions about how did I know, how did the government know, how did anybody know that so bin Laden was a participant.
Americans may have been long since persuaded, however, but it's not the case in the Middle East.
There's still the story that was the first story that circulated very widely and mm-hmm. was carried by some government press that, you know, all the Jewish Americans didn't show up for work that day. Mm-hmm. This was a Mossad thing. And we sort of laughed that away, but it had a deep belief out there.
So the Bush administration sees this as a way of penetrating that view.
And they were trying to figure out what's the best way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some discussion that perhaps if some other country, some country out in that area, were to be the releasing country, it would have more credibility. And mm-hmm. that triggered the first debate because there were people within the government who said, no, that would be discovered. And then the whole debate would be over why we were using somebody else and not over right. the substance of the mm-hmm. tape.
And have you heard it discussed as a piece of legal evidence? Is this something that would or could hold up in a court of law?
It's never really been discussed that way because if you talk to the people who sort of have the documentation, they say there's plenty of evidence up to now. I think this is a key piece in the court of public opinion mm-hmm. and not in any trial.
A simple videotape. Walter Pincus, did you hear who actually picked it up?
They've been very secretive about that. And the one thing I heard is that they believe there may be others and they didn't want to sort of cause any problem for where it comes from, although certainly bin Laden knows where the tape was made.
Walter Pincus is a reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke to us from Washington. The problem is daunting. Heroin is devastating cities in Europe, Russia, Pakistan, and the United States. But the opium poppy is the king cotton of Afghanistan. How, then, does the United States fight the war on drugs and help Afghanistan get back on its feet after the war on terrorism? Where should the line be drawn between the war on terror and the war on drugs? Should the United States take this opportunity to wipe out Afghan heroin? And what responsibility does the United States and the coalition have to help Afghanistan on its feet without opium poppies? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now from Madison, Wisconsin is Alfred McCoy. He teaches history at the University of Wisconsin and is author of The Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade. Good evening, Alfred McCoy.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. We're well, thanks.
Thank you.
Also with us is Jack Beatty, our special coverage news analyst from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Alfred McCoy, how important is Afghanistan to the global heroin trade?
Tremendously important. During the 1990s, Pakistan, Afghanistan supplied about 70% up to 75% of the world's heroin supply. The steady expansion of heroin production in Afghanistan dominated that country's economy. Moreover, the traffic in heroin from Afghanistan through Central Asia, the Caucasus and the Balkans into Europe, financed and fueled a phenomenal eruption of ethnic insurgency that followed the breakup of the Soviet Union. Many of the crises that we've been following throughout the decade of the 1990s, the Chechen Revolt, the North Ossetian Revolt, the struggle over Nagorno-Karabakh, the gangs in Bosnia, the fighting in Kosovo, all of these ethnic armies have been participants in a traffic that's been moving heroin east from Afghanistan to Europe and moving money and arms in the opposite direction. So it's
That's quite a list you're ticking off there, Alfred McCoy. Walk us through, if heroin, Afghan heroin, is the subtext for all those eruptions, walk us through how that happens. What's the trail that leads from the poppy fields of, I guess, northern Afghanistan through all the crises that you've just mentioned?
Well, the routes are ever-changing, but basically across this 3,000-mile span from the Balkans to Afghanistan, there are, I guess, three major trafficking routes. One is from Afghanistan directly into Iran. Iran has the second highest addict population in the world, probably. Officially, it's around 1,500,000. Unofficially, it's as high as 3 million.
Wow. That's
a direct route. The other route is eastward, through the Khyber Pass into Pakistan. Pakistan's official heroin addict population is the highest in the world, somewhere around 1,700,000. Those are the two main routes. There's another route which accounts for about 40% of Afghans' exports, and that moves through a complex of routes. First of all, directly north through former Soviet Central Asia into Russia itself, where the heroin is fueling an incredible proliferation of addiction and also HIV infection. And then it moves westward through former Soviet Central Asia, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, crosses the Caspian Sea, and then crosses through the Caucasus, which are an incredibly volatile region with lots of ethnic and national conflict. Then it goes across and around the Black Sea and enters the Balkans, where all of the gangs that have been fighting the ethnic wars during the 1990s have been financing themselves from narcotics. Just to take one example, the United States in 1999 was very supportive of the Kosovo Liberation Army. Mm-hmm. Most of the leaders of the army and most of the arms of the Kosovo Liberation Army were purchased by exports of heroin from through the Balkans into Western Europe. And there was indeed a Kosovar expatriate network all across Western Europe, particularly strong in Switzerland, for example, which imported heroin, sold it locally to local dealers on the streets, purchased arms, and sent them back to Kosovo.
Jack Beattie, are you hearing this? Alfred McCoy is painting Afghan heroin as kind of the background music for almost for a whole swath of the crises of the 90s.
It sounds that way. Is the implication that in dealing with the regime problem in Afghanistan and putting in a regime that would be more pliant, that this could change at the source? Are you confident of that at all, Professor?
Change at the source. The opposite is going to happen. The commanders who are rising to power are people whom the Taliban pushed aside when they took power. They either confiscated their arms or they forced them to retire. And the Taliban, of course, banned opium last year. Now these commanders have reopened their armories. They're retaking local power, and the poppy is back. In fact, what we're going to see is a post-Taliban government whose regional and local commanders and officials are drug lords. We're going to see a post-Taliban government in which the potentially major source of government finance, aside from foreign aid, almost all of the export income, and the largest single employer in the country is going to be opium and heroin. We're dealing with a remarkable phenomenon in Afghanistan that nobody has really appreciated throughout the past decade. We've got the world's first opium monocrop.
What do you mean by that? You mean the single crop of an entire nation?
Yeah, well, you know, the old cliche in the American South, cotton was king. That's not to say there weren't other crops, but cotton was clearly, in the antebellum South, the absolutely dominant crop. In pre-Castro Cuban, even under Fidel Castro himself, sugar, although, again, it wasn't by no means the only crop in Cuba, it was clearly the dominant crop. The world sugar price absolutely set the pace of the economy inside Cuba. So for lots of crops, particularly in the Grand Colonial Plantation Age, monocrop was not either regionally or nationally was quite common, but we've never had an opium monocrop before.
So you're saying in Afghanistan, poppies are the super dominant crop?
Yeah. In 1999, let's just look at the situation right on the eve of the Taliban's
Professor
decision.
McCoy, hold that thought. We're going to have to take a quick break first.
Sure.
We're talking with Professor Alfred McCoy. He teaches history at the University of Wisconsin about heroin in Afghanistan. It's the super dominant crop. It's the king cotton. Now we're coming into a period where we're talking about reconstruction and a new Afghanistan. How can we wean Afghanistan off heroin at the same time that we try to put its population back to work? How can reconstruction compete with heroin production? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. Special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Afghanistan and heroin this hour. In this memorable speech before the Labour Party, British Prime Minister Tony Blair addressed Taliban complicity in the international drug trade.
The biggest drugs hoard in the world is in Afghanistan, controlled by the Taliban. 90% of the heroin on British streets originates in Afghanistan. The arms the Taliban are buying today are paid for with the lives of young British people buying their drugs on British streets. That is another part of their regime we should seek to destroy.
We're talking tonight with Professor Alfred McCoy and our own news analyst Jack Beattie about heroin in Afghanistan. Alfred McCoy's pretty startling thesis here is that the drug lords, with the Taliban's fall, are now in charge and that Afghanistan is wholly dependent on heroin. Can we afford to wipe out Afghanistan's only cash crop? Can we afford not to? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Alfred McCoy, you were about to set into the history starting in 99, but if you would, take us even further back. When did the poppy and heroin come on the scene in Afghanistan, and take us through some of the history that brings us up to date?
Sure, very quickly. It's a change that's taken place over the last 20 years. When the CIA's covert war in Afghanistan started in 1979...
Against the Soviets.
A war that was mounted to drive the Soviet army, Red Army, out of Afghanistan. Mm. Afghanistan produced around 200 or 250 tons of opium that was mainly smuggled into Iran to fuel that country's insatiable appetite for smoking opium. There was no heroin production in the region, and Afghan opium nor Pakistan opium really entered the international traffic. Now, during the decade of covert warfare against Soviet occupation, the CIA pumped in $3 billion to arm the Mujahideen guerrillas. And the guerrillas, as they took over territory inside Afghanistan, ordered peasants to pay a revolutionary tax by planting opium, particularly in the big southeastern corner of the country. That opium was then smuggled across the border into the northwestern frontier.
Was the CIA aware of that?
Yeah, everybody knew that. It was smuggled across the border into the northwestern frontier of Pakistan, where there were hundreds of heroin labs, operating under the informal protection of the CIA's collaborating agency, the Pakistani Inter-Service Intelligence.
I guess that's the point. They were not only aware, they were sort of complicit, you're saying, in that heroin traffic.
I suppose, yeah. I mean, they knew what was going on. Indeed, in fact, when the war was over, the CIA officer that headed up the Afghan operation in Washington, a man named Charles Cogan, gave an interview to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation television, which he said on camera, and it's been shown in many NPR television stations across the country. He said on camera, he said, look, there was fallout in terms of drugs, but don't forget, we won the war.
It makes it sound as though this was a funding source for the war that was given a blind eye, therefore.
Yeah, I mean, it was not just a funding source for the war, but it was keeping the whole society inside the resistance areas alive.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the 1970s, before this fighting started, Afghanistan was supporting a very large population in a very fragile ecology, and this was only possible because of a delicate balance between three major forms of food. One was herding, mm-hmm. and the Afghanis practice very elaborate, it's called transhumance, the moving of crops from summer pasture to winter pasture, mm-hmm. over hundreds of miles of terrain. Moreover, they had orchards mulberry and walnut trees that, going back literally centuries, have been a kind of poor man's famine relief to survive the inevitable periodic famines in an age before international famine relief came in. And these trees were critically important for human survival. And in the indigenous tribal warfare of the area, they ravaged the annual crops, maybe killed the herds, but never touched the trees because that's kind of like thermonuclear war, invited retaliation in kind, which is death for all. And then Afghanistan also had a delicate balance of about 60-plus field crops. Well, of course, in under the conditions of modern warfare with high firepower and the incredible brutality of the Soviet army, the trees were ravaged, the herds were destroyed, not to mention the annual crops. And so over time, during this decade of war, Afghanistan's opium production went from about 200 or 250 tons to about 2,200 tons. It was a tenfold increase. And then under the conditions of civil war in the early 1990s, again, the same thing. The destruction ravaged and disrupted all other forms of activity except the opium. And then when the Taliban took power in 96, they supervised a doubling of the opium crop, and they brought it up to its historic peak of 4,600 tons in 1999. Now, that's an incredible number. That was about 75% of the world's heroin supply. And when you look at that, you know, the alternative crop, the dominant alternative crop to opium in Afghanistan is wheat. Wheat only takes about 40 labor days a year per hectare. Opium takes 350. It's nine times as labor-intensive. After the war, Afghanistan's economy was ravaged, had a huge surplus of labor. Unemployment in 1999 in Kabul was about 70%. That's 70%. Seven out of ten people didn't have
a lot of idle hands to work on poppy fields.
And that meant that opium was probably the largest single employer in Afghanistan. There would be summer seasonal employment for a million laborers in 1999. That's tremendous. So,
Alfred McCoy, hang on. I want to get more into the Taliban's relationship with opium. But before we do, I want to bring Jack Beatty in here. Jack, you hear what Alfred McCoy is describing, this centuries-old economy absolutely trashed and replaced by one crop, opium.
Yeah, we've been calling Afghanistan a failed state, but it sounds like in strange way it was a kind of a criminal enterprise under the guise of a failed state. I mean, if anybody thinks the war on drugs, the American war on drugs, is making any headway, the person has to be in the McCaffrey family. You know, when you look for models of what how alternative agricultural alternative development to poppy seeds could be, you look in at Colombia, and I saw some figures today that between 92 and 98, we funded the destruction of about 140 hectares of cocoa fields at coca field, and production tripled. So if that's an example, and recently the Colombian ombudsman complained that our efforts, we have a program down there of $101.3 billion aid program to the government to stamp out this cocoa production, that the Colombian ombudsman said that the spraying was not distinguishing between legal and illegal crops, and that it was decimating even the illegal crops. So there we are. We're spending $1 billion a year in Colombia, and things are only getting worse, and we're involving ourselves with death squads and a repressive military to do it. And the thought of how this is going to happen in Afghanistan is just beyond anybody's ken.
Jack, Professor McCoy, stand by. We have a caller who wants to join the conversation. Dan is on the line. Welcome, Dan. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi.
My question is this. If Professor McCoy is correct and the incoming coalition government is going to adopt a very pro-opium position and the Northern Alliance is too, then to what extent has this assisted the Northern Alliance in defeating the Taliban? To what extent has the Northern Alliance's pro-opium position contributed to their public support?
You mean, did it win them support from people who wanted to get back to planting poppies? How about that,
right,
Professor McCoy?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. It's actually even truer than the caller might be imagined. This is hypothetical. Mm-hmm. One of the One of the mysteries of the war in Afghanistan is why the Taliban collapsed so quickly. There appears to be no explanation. There are a number of possible military explanations. But what nobody is looking at, because we don't have good information, is, of course, you know, a critical factor in any war, which is the home front, the support from the people or the lack thereof. Mm-hmm. And I would put forward the following hypothesis, okay, that one of the reasons I think that the Taliban fell so quickly is that in July 28th of last year, the Taliban...
Last year, that is last summer year, or 2000?
2000, last, okay. Last year. We're still in 2001.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, ticking away, but we're still here. Okay, in July 28, 2000, the Taliban issued an absolute opium ban. Mm-hmm. And it was in the areas under their control, in the 90% of Afghanistan under their control, the ban was 99% or 100% effective.
So production and just plummeted.
It crashed from that figure in 1999 of 4,600 tons. It went all the way down from 4,600 tons to 185 tons.
Why did they do that?
Well, that's a complex thing. I think what they were trying to do was to win international recognition, because only a few weeks after they banned opium at the end of July, in September they sent a very high profile delegation to the United Nations, in press addresses and speeches around the UN, they denounced the Northern Alliance as drug lords, said that these people were not worthy to hold Afghanistan's seat, and they demanded that the seat be given to them.
Mm-hmm.
In 1997, right after they took power, the Taliban had admitted the UN drug control program, and they'd kind of tantalized the UN with the idea of, look, We'll ban drugs if you'll give us international recognition.
Mm-hmm.
So the Taliban banned drugs. They were absolutely devastatingly effective in doing so. And what did they do? They wiped out their major source of tax revenue.
Mm-hmm.
They wiped out the employer for the largest single employer in the country, probably employing over half the country's actual employed workforce.
Mm-hmm.
They destroyed the major source of export income for the country. In short, they devastated their only cash crop. It would be as if in, let's say, at the start of the Civil War in 1861, as if the South had decided to ban cotton, okay?
As they went into
the
war.
They wouldn't have had an economy left.
So no wonder they fell so quickly. You're saying they really blew away public support and their own economy by...
It was economic evisceration that left behind a hollow shell of military power that appears to have shattered with the first bombs.
Did the Taliban know that? We read reports that in September this year they were reversing themselves. Is that true as far as you know?
That's absolutely correct. Pete Hamill, for example, in a recent column in the New York Daily News, said that the Taliban radio on September 2nd announced that opium planting could be resumed, and there have been other reports as well. Yeah, around the time that the war broke out, the Taliban reversed themselves, and since the planting season goes on until just a couple of weeks ago, it varies from year to year, and where you are in Afghanistan, the liberation of the Taliban areas and the Taliban rescission of the ban has effectively meant there's been widespread planting of opium all across Afghanistan. It's going to be, depending on weather, a bumper crop next year.
But here we are with the international community coming in after a victory that you're saying may in part have been driven by the absence of opium, but opium politics in any case. And now we're reading that the bill for reconstructing, rebuilding Afghanistan could be anywhere from $6.5 billion to $25 billion over the next 5 or 10 years. If we pull poppies, if we pull heroin out of Afghanistan, does it make it that much harder? How do we simultaneously prop that country up and take away its number one cash crop?
I don't think we can do it. First of all, I don't really think the international community or the United States has any capacity to really stick with this redevelopment program for the decade-long period that's going to be required. The international community is used to rebuilding devastated rural societies that basically get their calories from annual crops, from field crops.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to rebuild the herds, and particularly to reestablish the orchards, which are so critical for rural survival in this semi-arid society, it's going to take the better part of a decade. Yeah, and the international community has also been very cool to Afghanistan. For example, in 1997, the head of the UN Drug Control Program, the former Italian Senator Pino Arlacchi, said that wiping out, total crop eradication and substitution for Afghanistan would cost the international community around $17 million, and he passed the hat internationally. He only got $8 million internationally. The United States pledged $3 million. Mm. We only paid up $1 million. That's $1 million out of a drug war budget that's $19 billion. The world has not proved generous towards Afghanistan. Moreover, I think that the program might last 2, 3, 4 years, but that's not going to do it.
Jack Beatty, can you see the international community threading this delicate situation, getting the thread through this needle?
As the professor lays it out, I can't. It isn't as if you can just revive an economy by, you know, snapping your fingers, and models like the Marshall Plan don't work because there really isn't much of an economy there at all.
But we've seen the threat. If something isn't done, it became a breeding ground for terrorists. If we can't rebuild it, are we just going to police it to death?
You know, you wonder about that, whether this is going to become a sort of international basket case, sort of recolonized by, either Western troops or forces that essentially answer to Western powers, sort of keeping the lid on. I don't know. I mean, it just sounds like a fearful prospect ahead of this country, given this drug complication and the sort of nature in which it sounds as if drugs are almost a legitimate, you know, they act as a kind of legitimator of the regime. I mean, we'll keep you in power, we'll be loyal citizens, but you're going to let us do the poppy. This is an extraordinary complication.
Alfred McCoy, what's your view? How do we rebuild? There's a commitment. Washington goes on talking about the commitment. Only yesterday, Richard Haass at the State Department was saying, this time around, the help will be there. President Bush says the U.S. will not walk away from Afghanistan.
Well, during the 1980s, we were all really concerned about the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. We invested $3 billion of covert aid to the Mujahideen resistance to Soviet occupation, $3 billion. And when it was over and we negotiated our way out of there, we paid almost nothing. So we're on record, $3 billion for destruction and zero for reconstruction. Okay, that's the American record on Afghanistan. And if you look at what the Bush administration is saying, what the press is saying about it, they're very lukewarm in their commitment to the long-term reconstruction of Afghanistan. What the Bush administration really wants to do is to pursue the war on terror, both with police action all across Europe and the world to track down the remnants of al-Qaeda and possibly open new theaters of combat. The next one, of course, is Iraq, where Washington's very keen to explore the possibilities of military operations against Iraq. During the presidential debates, the words that George Bush sneered out during those debates, nation building, as if they're dirty words. I can't believe that such an administration, which is publicly committed to war on terror, is suddenly going to drop everything to reconstruct Afghanistan.
So haven't we had quite an object lesson since then in the importance of not having these unraveled corners of the world just festering?
Yeah, one would think so. One of the legacies of the Cold War is everywhere around the globe where we pursued these covert wars, we generally left regional instability, ravaged societies, and real trouble spots. One is Angola. We pursued a covert war in Angola supporting the South Africans and UNITA in Angola. That's still a festering sore that we've walked away from.
McCoy, hold the thought. We've got to take a break. We're talking about heroin and Afghanistan. It sounds pretty challenging. Will the United States stick around to pull Afghanistan out of the poppy fields and up on its feet? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about heroin and Afghanistan. Our guest tonight, Alfred McCoy, author of The Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade, says that if you pull heroin out of Afghanistan, you pull the heart out of Afghanistan's economy. How do we reconstruct Afghanistan and do something about the heroin trade? Can we do it? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Garen is on the line. Welcome, Garen. You're on the air.
No, this is Michael.
Oh, hello, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Happy to have you.
Three very quick points. Number one, I know it's been talked about a lot, but my first point is that drugs and heroin specifically, or you know, drugs in general, are a demand problem, not a supply problem. That having been said, my second point is that having heard an audio postcard on NPR many, many weeks ago from a producer who was in Afghanistan at the age of 12, saying how industrious and hardworking and kind of modern the Afghans were.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, that was a great audio postcard.
Yes, it was.
Very surprising. I want to know what the plans are for American corporations once we have a secular society in Afghanistan to go in and start cutting deals. I mean, here's a country of probably 60 or 70 or 80% unemployment. I know it sounds like the penultimate kind of capitalist solution, but why aren't corporations saying, look, you know, we'll provide jobs. We have a labor force over there that's inexpensive. Now, obviously, it's going to need a secular government. But you know, are there plans for that?
Sounds like it could be a tall order. But the Chamber of Commerce solution sounds like it would beat the heroin solution. Alfred McCoy, can you see the international economy engaging with Afghanistan in such a way that it would be more attractive than heroin?
No infrastructure. Where's transportation? Hydroelectric facilities, inexpensive power grid, and also when you're in Afghanistan, you're 3,000 miles from anywhere. What are you going to export where and to? India? No, that's a self-contained economy. It's very dynamic. It's exporting. Iran? That's not an open economy. Russia? Well, again, you've got the vast. No, it's not logical. I mean, over time, in 10 years, when the infrastructure has been rebuilt, that's a possibility. But for the next decade, the perverse genius of the opium poppy solves all of Afghanistan's problems. Just to look at the problems, okay? First of all, it's a semi-arid society. So
semi-arid terrain and climate there, meaning a lot of desert.
Right. The water-efficient tree crops have been pretty much ravaged. The herds are pretty much gone. So you're reliant upon annual crops. Not only is the land arid, but there's actually very little of it that's really arable, that's useful for agriculture. Mm-hmm. And so the farms are very small. So farmers have got to get a high income off a very small bit of land. You can make maybe $100 from a hectare of wheat. You can probably get $10,000 from a hectare of opium.
Alfred McCoy, I've got to ask you, because our time is running down, the planners around the world who are looking at Afghanistan now are not fools, and they know the same numbers you know. Is it possible that behind all the talk of reconstruction, there's a kind of tacit acceptance of heroin production to keep factions there happy, to keep Afghanistan solvent? Is it possible that that's actually part of the plan?
I don't think so, no. But if you were to sit down and hypothetically look at the problems of Afghanistan and come up with the perfect crop that would solve the country's short-term problems, that crop would be opium.
But as you said, it's sown chaos across much of the region all the way into Europe for the last decade. So it can't really be tolerated from that standpoint, can it?
It has enormous problems. But let's look at the other thing. Okay, if we begin a process of eradicating opium in Afghanistan, is that going to solve the world's drug problem? The United States and the United Nations have been fighting a war on drugs for the past 30 years. What's the net result of that war? Okay, in 1971, when we started our drug war in Turkey, the world produced 1,000 tons of illicit opium. Today, it produces over 6,000 tons. In the last 15 years, we've extended the drug war to the Andes, and coca production has doubled in the Andes since we started our drug war. Back in 1970, the United States had about 68,000 heroin addicts, or rounded up 70,000 heroin addicts. Today, we have over a million. So, in other words, and what is the reason? It's not just that the drug war isn't working. There is a perverse logic to the drug war that nobody understands. It's what I call the stimulus of prohibition. Very simply, what happens in any agricultural commodity when demand is constant and there's a shortfall in supply? Price goes up, and next year, because the price is higher, farmers around the globe plant more. So when we
Alfred McCoy, our time is running down, but you're giving us quite a startling economics lesson on the heroin front tonight. We thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Alfred McCoy teaches history at the University of Wisconsin. He's author of The Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade. Jack Beatty, are we sobered yet?
I'm sobered. And then when you look at the demand side, you know, we spent two times for what we spend on after-school programs for teens that would keep them busy and away from drugs. We spent two times that on anti-drug commercials that nobody thinks has any effect. So this whole war on drugs is taken a perverse course. It's getting worse, not better, and we have here a whole economy tied up with it. My only hope is that something like the Cambodian model will be applied here. And in Cambodia, when that country was reconstructed, the UN basically gave every farmer $150 for the year and let him plant his crops. And it was essentially saying, well, we'll pay you for the whole year here, waiting for your wheat or whatever rice to come in.
So we may be subsidizing Afghanistan the same way soon.
I think we're going to have to be paying them out of pocket if we don't want them corrupting, you know, hooking the world.
Jack, we got to go, but thanks for your time tonight.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org, click on Special Coverage Forums. Tonight, we continue our week-long series with the Project for Muslim Understanding. Six Muslim PhD candidates from across the country have come together since the terrorist attacks on America to analyze the global trends which contributed to the events of September 11th. Joining us now is Ibrahim Kalin. He's currently a PhD candidate in the Human Sciences program at George Washington University. His paper is entitled The Roots of Misconception, Islam in the West. Welcome, Ibrahim Kalin.
Thank you.
Tell us about your paper and why you decided to take on the subject.
Well, we're trying to put a kind of things in historical perspective as far as the relation between Islam and the West is concerned. I'm looking at the historical development of the relation between these two sister civilizations, all the way from the rise of Islam in the 7th century through the Middle Ages and the Renaissance and the modern period. And when we look at that history, it may provide some clues as to how we can understand the current situation.
You know, here we are in the year 2001, and looking over your paper, I get this feeling that we are, on both sides, such prisoners of history.
Yes, we are, in fact. And that's why we need to know that history, in order to go beyond the received categories of kind of stereotypes that we're presented with about the Islamic world, the Muslim people, and the West.
I guess I'd be interested first how the Islamic world sees the West in those received stereotypes, and then your sense of how the West is trapped in its view of Islam.
Well, there was a dramatic change with the rise of the modern West as the kind of dominant paradigm of the modern world beginning in the 16th and 17th centuries. From that time on, the Muslim world looked at the West as the superior power, but as that power which had certain installments and interests in its own land in the Islamic world proper, and that has created a sense of reaction, a sense of kind of resentment towards the West. Also, there was the kind of intellectual challenge coming, you know, with the rise of some modern ideologies such as modernism, secularism, etc., which were not easy to reconcile with the traditional Islamic beliefs and practices in the Islamic world. And you have a number of scholars and intellectuals in the Islamic world trying to respond.
At this point, is it possible for people in the Islamic world to separate the West and Christendom? Do they pull apart the religion and the secular power any longer, or is it all one?
Well, it's very difficult, especially for people in the Islamic world, to do it. There are many, many subtleties within the Western world, but they are not known to the Islamic world. So in a sense, we can say there is this much kind of homogeneous thinking, monolithic categories in the Islamic world about the West as there is about the Islamic world in the West itself. But for an ordinary Muslim looking at the Western world, what they see is a long list of philosophers, theologians, scholars, and political rulers and leaders, etc., who are all entrenched in a Judeo-Christian tradition. So in a sense, it's very difficult for them to separate religion from the other side of Western civilization, which is a kind of more secular type, which has come to the fore with the modern era. And this has something to do with the fact that in the Islamic world, civilization has always been wed to religion or set of religious ideas and practices.
And remains so.
Yes, it does remain so, certainly.
We'll turn this around in a second, but before we leave this perspective, what's the one thing that if you could free people in the Islamic world from the chains of history that you'd like them to perceive about the West that they may not popularly?
Well, first of all, they have to understand that there are many Wests. If you're talking about Europe, there are many Europes. If you're talking about America, there are many Americas. There is not one single America. There is not one single symbol to which everything say Western or American can be reduced. There needs to be a more kind of flexibility in understanding the West and its various tendencies. The West is not a purely religious civilization, but it's not a purely secular civilization. Mm-hmm. The West is not hostile completely to Islam. It's not completely friendly to Islam, etc. So you have, you know, the kind of a wide range of attitudes and reactions towards the Islamic world within the Western world, and that needs to be articulated.
Now let's turn it around and look at the West's view of Islam. How would you describe the dominant stereotype that captures most Western minds, and what are the roots of that stereotype?
Well, the best way to do that is to look at some of the historical facts. When Islam came upon the historical scene, it was received as a theological threat and rivalry.
And indeed, it was a challenge to Christianity.
Yes, it was a challenge to Christianity because Islam never claimed to be a new religion, but it claimed to be the lost religion in the long chain of Abrahamic revelations sent from heaven. Mm-hmm. And Islam addressed many issues that were common to both Judaism and Christianity.
But it was presented as the final word.
Yes, as the final kind of the completion of the great chain of being, if you like, or mm-hmm. great chain of revelation. Mm-hmm. But Islam differed with Christianity on some theological issues, such as the divinity of Jesus Christ and his crucifixion at the cross, etc., which are not accepted in the Islamic belief.
So it was a challenge in theological terms, and then you write about how the Crusaders arrived from Europe and found in the Middle East a much more advanced civilization than they were accustomed to, including physical goods, fine silks and fine foods, and they took this back to Europe both with admiration but also with this kind of image of the Muslim as a sybaritic pleasure lover.
That's right. This was the common attitude during the Middle Ages, and that continued during the Renaissance and the Enlightenment periods, this kind of ambiguous attitude towards Islam. But on the other hand, with the Crusades going to the Islamic world for the first time and having the experience of the Islamic world, its cities and all the other things that you mentioned, there was a kind of a change in the perception of Eastern Christians about the Islamic world as being a kind of more civilized world, but also at the same time as a land of, you know, worldly pleasures and promiscuity and luxury, etc.
You note that Renaissance Europe hated Islam as a religion but admired its civilization.
That's right. And we can see that in many of the writings of some of the luminaries of the Enlightenment period, they continued that kind of in rejecting Islam as a religion, but they continued to, in a sense, pit Islam against Christianity. Many of this kind of not-so-religious theologians and scholars of the 16th and 17th century saw in Islam an opportunity to kind of attack Christianity in a tacit way, in proposing it as a kind of alternative way of life, not in the sense of, you know, becoming Muslim, but in the sense of showing that there are other ways of living in the world. And in fact, Muslims have done it better. In science, in philosophy, in literature, in building cities, architecture, etc. And this was a kind of tacit challenge for Christianity.
I note from your paper that almost six centuries after the founding of Islam, you say there was still not a single scholar among Latin critics of Islam who knew Arabic. So it's not new that ignorance plagues this relationship.
Yes, certainly. Roger Bacon, you know, made that famous complaint in the 12th century. And in many ways, we are much better equipped today to know Islam as far as the study of Islam in American universities is concerned. But as far as the kind of general public is concerned, we are still long away from really having a good grasp of what Islam is. And this is kind of, in a sense, natural because we're much more familiar with the Judeo-Christian tradition. When something happens related to Christianity or Judaism, we are in a better position to appreciate the diversity. And we can say, for example, David Koresh does not represent Christianity. Or Baruch Goldstein, who entered the Khalil Mosque in 1994 and killed more than 38, you know, Muslims praying, did not represent Christianity.
But we're not yet equipped to do the same when it comes to Islam.
Yes, exactly. When it comes to Islam, since we do not know its tradition, its history, its beliefs and practices, its incredible richness and diversity, we are not in a position to make that appreciation yet.
Well, it's sad that it took the tragedy of 9/11 to enrich the conversation, but we thank you for helping us enrich it today.
Thank you for having me.
Ibrahim Kalin is a PhD candidate in the Human Sciences program at George Washington University. His paper is entitled The Roots of Misconception, Islam and the West. Tomorrow we talk to another Muslim PhD candidate about her view of the so-called clash of civilizations. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you.